Hello, and welcome to this week's podcast episode in the Neurobiology of Sex series. My name is Abiola Irvine, and on today's episode, we're going to be exploring copulation in humans. So one thing I've learned working at an after-school program is that kids tend to say the darnest things. For example, one of my students asked me the other day why teacher Michael had a fuzzy face, but I didn't. He was referring to his beard. So my first thought is, how in the world am I going to explain hormone organization and activation to a four-year-old? But long story short, he was pretty satisfied with the best answer I could come up with on the spot, which was magic. But quite honestly, I don't think that's too far off from the real thing. The complex processes of the human brain are as near to magic as we'll probably get. So let's start with a quick thought exercise. When I ask you to think of a difference between men and women, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Okay, time's up. All right, so what'd you come up with? Maybe some physical differences, like how men have testes and women have ovaries? Or maybe you were thinking of some behavioral differences, like why young boys always seem to play so much more rough than girls? Or better yet, maybe your mind went to hormones, thinking about estrogen and testosterone levels and their crucial role in mediating the organization and activation of reproductive mechanisms in our body. Regardless of what came to mind, whether it be behavioral, physical, or hormonal, it's pretty clear that there are some differences between men and women. These different characteristics between sexes of the same species are called sexual dimorphisms. Sexual dimorphisms are seen across other species too. Take a lion, for instance. Males tend to have that big, luxurious, fluffy mane, whereas females don't. So, have you ever wondered why a lot of these underlying differences exist? The answer lies in the brain. In the same way we see differences in behavior and appearance, there are also differences in the male and female brain, which can lead to differences in things such as how we perceive and process sexual stimuli. Oh, you don't believe me? All right, hang on, I've got something to show you. There you are. Been waiting on you. Well, here we are. The brain. Well, the midbrain to be specific. We're going to make a couple stops in the limbic system. No, not limbo. Limbic. The limbic system is a set of brain structures that are strongly linked to emotion, memory, and motivation. Ah, there's the little guy. Okay. So we've just arrived at the hypothalamus, and this brain region plays a crucial role in appetite control, fight or flight response, and sexual behavior, also known as the four Fs. Feeding, fighting, flight, and fornication. This region is also very involved in the modulation of hormones. And hormones are everything. Well, maybe not everything, but hormones are very important in our everyday lives because they are involved with the activation, suppression, and modulation of important behaviors like sex. Some fMRI imaging studies done in humans have linked the hypothalamus to sexual motivation and desire based on results that show there's more activation in this region during the initial phases of sexual arousal. This makes sense, honestly, because this region is really important in the release of estrogen, testosterone, and other gonadal hormones that mediate reproductive behavior. And if we keep moving along here, so now we're at the medial preoptic area. And wow, this one is actually pretty big. We must be in a male brain. The medial preoptic area is part of the anterior hypothalamus, and it's a sexually dimorphic brain region in humans, and it's usually a lot larger in males. This region is really important in regulating sexual motivation in males too. And not just in humans, in fact, in all species studied up until now, we see that when you inactivate this area, males show no motivation to engage in sex. But anyway, we're gonna head south a little bit to the amygdala, where I have a special surprise waiting for you guys. So the amygdala is known for being the control center for emotion in the brain, which is really important for learning and how we behave. All right, here we are. Oh, perfect, she's here. So today I'm bringing on a special guest, Jamie LaRue, a fellow Haverford student and dear friend of mine. And she's gonna help us learn a little bit more about the amygdala's role in sex behavior based on a 2004 study by Stephen Hammond et al.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to bring my political science and economics perspective to the conversation. So, thanks.
Of course, it's a pleasure. So Jamie and I have already gone over the study, but to sum up the purpose of it, they were looking at the differences in amygdala and hypothalamus activation between men and women when they were showed porn. And they ultimately found that men tend to show more activation in both the amygdala and hypothalamus in the presence of visual stimuli. They tend to show more activation than women, actually. So Jamie, off the bat, did you have any initial reactions or questions about this study that you want to bring up that you think might be helpful to our listeners?
So how would we, I guess, my question is, how would we explain anomalies in the study? So what would we say for a man who didn't exhibit the same, you know, elevated stimuli as all the other males? Would we just say, oh, you know, he has a medical condition?
I mean, I don't know if we could necessarily jump to that conclusion, but that's definitely the right direction to be looking in. So if he's rating the stimuli to be lower and showing less levels of activation, it could just be that that porn isn't his flavor, you feel me? But if we see that he's rating things below baseline and his fMRI activation is below baseline as well, that may be the time to look a little further and see if there could be something going on neurally that's inhibiting his sexual motivation.
We know that would be the same specifically based on biological gender, but I think that brings up an interesting point because, like, here's what I know what would happen, but I think based off of sexual orientation, would that actually change some of these biological, you know?
Yeah, that's definitely a great question. I was wondering a little bit about that too, because in this study, they actually controlled for sexual orientation by making sure that all of their participants were heterosexual. And I was really curious to see how sexual orientation would have, or if it would have changed the data at all, because they were just looking at differences between biological men and biological women. And I think that's a place where science really needs to kind of take that next step and go further and look at some of these more complex mechanisms of sex behavior in humans, which can be really hard to do, granted, as our neural system is a lot more complex, and doing studies in humans can be a little bit more limited than doing studies in animals.
And I think that's a place where science is falling short, is because I think in society we're evolving, sex is evolving, right? What it means to have sex, the conversation surrounding that, you know, sex doesn't just involve, you know, it looks different for every circumstance, every situation, every couple, you know, homosexual, heterosexual, non-binary identifying individuals. And so I think science, along with the ways in which we're kind of having discussions about this, needs to evolve at the same pace as, you know, how can we use science as a way to kind of expand.
Right. And hopefully with studies like these, they give a good preliminary basis of baseline data so we can move forward to make those next steps. Well, Jamie, as much as I love hanging out with you in the amygdala, I think it's time I got out of here and cleaned off my shoes. So, thanks again for taking the time out to talk with me about sex. And special thanks to all of our listeners tuning in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course.
Sex on.